normal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Tammy Thies, founder and executive director of the Wildcat Sanctuary. Located in Sandstone, Minnesota, the Wildcat Sanctuary is a nonprofit rescue refuge specialized in exploited, aging, and illegally owned wildcats. Established in 1999, the facility now provides ongoing refuge to more than 150 wildcats, often playing a major role in helping mitigate the crises that emerge after a raid on a roadside zoo or other nefarious operation that houses exotic animals. Indeed, there's a current news story involving West Coast Game Park, an egregious roadside attraction in Oregon, now closed down nearly a year after authorities seized 300 animals, as well as large amounts of cash, drugs, and guns. This illustrates how the Wildcat Sanctuary can step into such a scenario and provide a nurturing home for some of the affected animals. The animals these and the Wildcat Sanctuary took in from the West Coast Game Park case include a black jaguar named Louie, a leopard, Bentley, an African lioness, Nasha, and the Eurasian lynx, Lila. These four cats came to the Wildcat Sanctuary needing particular care, which the sanctuary is uniquely equipped to provide by way of an on-site animal care and education center that includes a veterinary hospital, lab, pharmacy, and surgical suite, and plenty of space to the tune of 200 acres. Coming up later on today's program, I'll air my interview with Congressman Maxwell Alejandro Frost, who represents Florida's 10th District, which includes Orlando. Orlando is where a horrific story played out recently involving an enterprise called Sloth World, leading to the death of more than 30 sloths, and of course, plenty of national outrage as well. Representative Frost played a very active role in ending the Sloth World debacle. We'll hear my conversation with him a bit later here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Right now, though, let's get into our conversation with Tammy Thies about the Wildcat Sanctuary. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Tammy Thies to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Tammy.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. I was thinking, I've been doing the show long enough and interviewed so many sanctuary founders that it occurred to me in preparing today's interview that this has sort of become the norm, at least within the walls of this show. But overall, of course, launching and running a sanctuary is not the norm. But I think those who do so are noteworthy, and especially those with your impressive track record should be celebrated and studied and explored. So let's get to some studying here.
Okay.
If you don't mind recounting your origin story for yet another time, tell me how the Tammy Thies narrative traveled this path.
Most people aren't an executive director of a wildlife sanctuary, and I wasn't going down that path either. I was a journalism and marketing major, and through my years in advertising, saw animals being used for entertainment and for profit, and it just really broke my heart and kind of started researching why animals are used for profit, especially big cats, and found that there wasn't a lot of regulation at that time 20 years ago, and there was a lot of animals being used and then tossed aside and caused surplus of captive wildcats in the U.S. And so I ended up meeting actress Tippi Hedren, who owned Shambhala Preserve in California, which is a true sanctuary, and she set me on the path that there, if we're going to advocate for these animals to be retired or not to be exploited or abused, that there needs to be a place for them to go. And so the Wildcat Sanctuary was founded back in 1999.
So tell me more about the role Tippi Hedren played in the birth and kind of evolution of the Wildcat Sanctuary. She's been a guest on Talk Animals three times over the years. She's really sharp and obviously really committed to protecting big cats and their welfare. That's all I could do when I had her on the show, not to ask her about Alfred Hitchcock, though.
Well, I've got to stay with Tippi, so I know a lot about Alfred Hitchcock and her whole movie career and her daughter and granddaughter, Dakota Johnson.
For sure.
And so I remember reaching out on a tiger that was being euthanized after being used for a photo shoot just to be pelted. And I couldn't find that it was illegal anywhere because he wasn't selling the pelt, this exploiter. And so I reached out to Tippi Hedren because she was in the Parade magazine and the Sunday newspaper, and I called her, the number that was in that article, thinking I'd get a big corporation. Nope, I got Tippi Hedren answering her phone for her sanctuary. And so she invited me out to her place to spend a week. I actually spent it in her trailer with her. Got to know her, got to know how you run a sanctuary and kind of about the captive wildlife crisis, as well about advocating for legislation to really protect these animals in captivity. And so we were colleagues and friends, and she was my mentor for several years. And now she's in her almost 90 years old now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, her sanctuary is kind of going on the guise of retirement, but we still have the captive wildlife crisis, even with the education and legislation. And so sanctuaries that are accredited, like the Wildcat Sanctuary, we're still picking up the pieces here in America.
And just to go back and clarify, so when you called her kind of out of the blue, mm-hmm. and she invited you out, she didn't know you from anyone else other than just a previous conversation or two, basically?
Yep, just a previous conversation that I wanted to do something to change this world that we were living in for the cats. Talked to her about my advertising background, and I stayed in her guest room. Her trailer smelled like domestic cats because she had quite a few of them at the time, even sure. helping with those. She put little chocolates on my pillow, and what I loved about her home is that she had cat doors in every bedroom and bathroom. So even though I slept in the bedroom, the domestic cats were allowed to come in and out as they wanted. And so she talked me through the staff. She talked me through why, you know, how the industry had changed, how it needed to continue to change. And then later in the year, she would invite me out during the Captive Wildlife Safety Act when she was advocating for that. And I stayed on site with her again and supported her in that legislation, which was the first big piece of legislation to protect big cats in America.
Yeah, I mean, what an incredible commitment she obviously yeah. demonstrated, because, again, just to respond to you with little or no background. And as far as you know, Tammy, were there other people that kind of she took under her wing and did that for as well, the way she treated you and had you come out and stay there? And
I'm sure there is. You know, I know that Bobby Brink from Lions, Tigers, and Bears talks to Tippi over the years, too. I think back then we didn't have the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance or the Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries, which now is coalitions of sanctuaries working together.
Yeah.
And so I think I was naive enough that I went to her place and then I would travel to other sanctuaries or facilities around the country and find out that some that said they were sanctuaries weren't at all. They were buy, breeding, selling, exploiting. And then there was these reputable sanctuaries, and that was before there was an association. And so I think being so young and naive, I was kind of like Switzerland. I was neutral, you know. Mm-hmm. And so after in the really early 90s, there was the first facility that closed down after Hurricane Katrina and other issues that had 50 big cats. And I used that network of traveling to other sanctuaries to reach out to everybody I knew and said, how do we help these 50 big cats? And that's kind of when all the sanctuaries started working together and formed American Sanctuary Association at the time. And, you know, ever since then, it has been a network of founders and, you know, people that have founded sanctuaries working together for one cause.
And just going back to the kind of the earlier part of your story, because you had this sort of marketing, advertising, journalism background. What, looking back now, or maybe it was clear at the moment, sometimes these things only become more clear after some yeah. years pass. What caught your interest so much? What made you say, hey, I've got to get involved. I don't like what's happening with the way these cats are treated or the way these other animals are treated. I've got to step in. Was there something in your background or something in your formative years growing up, et cetera, something that you could connect those dots?
There's absolutely. There was a photo shoot that had two tiger cubs in that was in the studio next to the advertising agency when we were doing a photo shoot. And like everybody else, I kind of was smitten at first. You know, these are cute cubs. There's a guy in a khaki shirt. This must be reputable. And then I started seeing how they were being yanked on chains, other things. You know, I asked to go see his facility, and it was told because he had no money. That's why they were all kept in 10 by 10s and 20 by 20 in pole buildings. He was dragging them to Renaissance Festival, photo shoots, you know, schools. And at first I believed him that he just needed more money. And then as I volunteered there for less than a year, I realized, no, this is about profit and about ego. This is not about the animals.
You smell the rat, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I saw some horrific things that I wish I knew now what I knew then, because at that point I could have gotten more evidence on the person. I could have found paper trails and things like that. There's been so many devastating things. He's had animal deaths by the dozens. He's had human deaths at his facility. He's still in operation under somebody else's permit, you know, years later. But that was really the catalyst.
Do you
want
to say, identify this person, or do you not want to identify this person?
I don't at this time. Because we're working still steadily to make sure people like him can't just keep moving and doing this over and over.
Probably don't
again.
Want to tip your hand that you're coming for him.
But he's just one example of many. You know, people heard of Tiger King and Joe Exotic and the West Coast Game Park that we're talking about today. I mean, had years and years of violations. And so the wheels of justice really turn slow, but it takes all of your listeners and people like that that make those complaints, even one complaint, it adds up. But we need that evidence, and we need you to film it, and we need you to, you know, write USDA or send it to facilities like ours that we can forward it on to authorities, that eventually they can build the case they need to shut these places down.
Yeah. Well, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Tammy Thies, founder and executive director of the Wildcat Sanctuary, a rescue refuge in Minnesota specializing in exploited, aging, and illegally owned wild cats. The Wildcat Sanctuary often plays a major role after a raid on a roadside zoo or other nefarious operation. We're going to talk a little bit about a current/recent example of that. But meanwhile, if you'd like to ask Tammy a question about the sanctuary, about their rescue work, about related topics, legislation, etc., please call 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So going back to your earliest days after spending time with Tippi Hedren and sort of figuring out what to do, once you'd established your own facility, describe what it was like to carry out your very own, like, first or second rescue and probably relocation in the manner that Tippi Hedren and other role models had kind of shown you.
Yeah, I mean, it first happened with a local rescue in Minnesota where a gentleman was aging out of the business. We went on site. There was four tigers. They were in what we call corn cribs here in Minnesota. They're like little fence silos, maybe 12 feet wide. The cat just kind of could turn around. It had a little den box, so every time she gave birth, they would pull the cubs out of the den box. They were selling them in the classifieds, things like that. And when we went on site, Tippi had given me other sanctuaries that could accommodate cats because I was brand new at the time. I wasn't going to just leap into tigers. I had done smaller cats and had a network of education and things like that. But this was the first time we had a 20-year-old tiger that another sanctuary at that time didn't want to move across country because of her age. And so that was kind of our first guise of having to rescue a tiger. And I'm very thankful that it was a very well-mannered tiger, because over the years, we know that there's fear aggression. When animals are mistreated, they can either shut down or they can lash out. And so she was one that was pretty complacent, you know, and her name was Mimi. And she really was the catalyst when I saw those living conditions firsthand of what I saw and how small it was and how small her life was, that I wanted to do something different. So started out very modest, you know, on 10 acres with 20 cats, and that was going to be our goal. And then over the years, moved to bigger properties and now are on 220 acres with 150 cats, you know, 25 staff members plus interns and volunteers, you know, and a full-time veterinarian. So things evolved slowly. And, you know, I'm so thankful for the other sanctuary members who helped me along the way, because there is not a rule book for this. You know, you go into it rescuing animals, but you have to be sustainable and you have to run an entire business, you know, from HR law to zoning to fundraising. It's not just about the animal care. There's so much more that goes into running an accredited facility.
Well, and also seems fundamental, but one of the things I've really learned over the years is that if someone doesn't have a bit of a business acumen that goes into this, they're in trouble at some point. I mean, trouble's coming, whether it's the first year or two or 5 years in. But if they don't have fundraising and other mechanisms in place or don't figure out how to do that, things go down.
Yeah, and we're seeing now.
The bills are too relentless, otherwise, to keep keep afloat.
Yeah, I mean, it's costing us upward of $20,000 a year to properly care for a tiger, from the time we rescue it to the intake exams to seeing a lot of the metabolic bone disease, the vet care we have to do, preventative care, vaccines, not to mention the food we feed, you know, and keeping on top of like COVID and bird flu that affects big cats. It's amazing what, you know, I always say, if I would have known what I was getting into 25 years ago, I probably wouldn't have done this. But I'm thankful I didn't know, and that we now have, you know, a network of the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance to work through everything. You know, bird flu's new. But what's not new is people wanting to touch and feel and breed and sell big cats in America. And, you know, we did have the Big Cat Public Safety Act passed in 2022 that really has made a huge effort to shut down that buying, breeding, and selling. But we still have some of these old school offenders like West Coast Game Park and other roadside zoos that are still breeding and selling behind the scenes. That's how they're making their money, not necessarily their $5 or $10 you pay at the door. And so
we'll get to them for sure.
Yeah.
Some people want to get involved in the conversation as well. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Tammy Thies. Hello, it's you. Oh, we might. Okay, well, they're on hold for a bit. Maybe they'll call back. No problem. Tell me about some of the more notable investigations we've touched on. You know, the West Coast Game Park, and that's kind of, I mean, it's a year or so old, but it's kind of current in the way that the guy fled.
What we've learned about a lot of these is we might be going in and assisting authorities for the animal welfare violations, but usually they're also tied to other criminal activities. And that's been a change. Over the years, it used to be, you know, somebody would call me, they had a pet tiger, it was getting too big, they needed to surrender it. And now it is legal actions. When we went in with West Coast Game Park, you know, there was probably 150 agents on site. And our role is to safely sedate, do vet care, and transport the big cats out of there. But Tiger King Park was another one where it took several sanctuaries to come on site to accommodate the removal of those animals. Sometimes it's your local sheriff department. We went on a local farm up north that had a bunch of wolves, bobcats, lynx, and just deplorable, like 10 by 10 enclosures with plastic strewed everywhere, no shelter, feces everywhere. And, you know, it's our job to remove those animals safely and not cause a public safety risk. And at the sanctuary, we can really, you know, we have two fences and habitats and double door entries. But when we go on to these places, some of them are rickety makeshift enclosures with no fence around it, you know, and so public safety is number one. And I think that really stands out with facilities like ours, is safety is number one, animal welfare is number two, because we don't want to be causing a bigger issue than we're going into. But it is, you know, it does not come without people calling and threatening us. People feel like their animals will not be seized. If we didn't give them a place to call home, they don't think then authorities would seize the animals. So sanctuaries get blamed a lot in the removal of animals, when really all we can do is offer a humane and safe service. We are not the ones shutting these facilities down. That is, you know, whether it be the
USDA. That's the authorities, really.
The authorities.
Yeah, we're just sort of helping out.
Yeah, we're an alternative to euthanasia. Yeah, we're an alternative to euthanasia is what we are at sanctuaries. So we are kind of the last funnel. Not only do we take from, you know, legal cases like this, we take private owner surrenders that might have bought them off the internet. We take unreleasable wildlife. Sadly, when they're deemed, you know, have an injury and can't go back in the wild, they go to sanctuary. There's even our accredited zoos retire animals and need a place to go. So when you look at sanctuaries across the country, we're kind of the safety net for a lot of different industries. But sadly, we're getting full and our industry is getting smaller. People that wanted 30 years ago to run this, we have even reputable sanctuaries closing their doors because of not necessarily funding, it's the lack of staff willing to go into this type of work in the future. And so that's something our industry is really working on. And how do we get a pipeline of people that are willing to commit to running the business side of sanctuaries, not just the animal care side?
Yeah, vexing, important question. Let's try to take another caller here. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Tammy Thies.
Hello?
Hello, it's you. Go ahead, please.
I just want to thank the guest for the work she's doing. Duncan, you amaze me every week I'm able to listen to this show. I find out about another wonderful animal sanctuary or organization, and it really brings me to tears some weeks. What I'm interested in learning more about is I'm not of the younger generation, but I'm of, let's say, the middle generation. And I am definitely interested in animal welfare. Let me just put it that way. But you're the first guest I've heard in a while on Duncan's show who speaks about these broader overarching organizations. I think you mentioned something called a Global Alliance of Animal Sanctuaries and some kind of American. Can you talk more about those?
Absolutely. The Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries is an organization that oversees accreditation of sanctuaries to make sure that not only are we meeting animal welfare goals, but fundraising, ethical fundraising goals, and hopefully sustainability. They can't, you know, sometimes you can't see into the future, but they're really the highest standards of animal care in the sanctuary business. And the biggest thing is sanctuaries don't buy, breed, trade, or sell animals. So we really want to stop the pipeline of the captive wildlife surplus. And so there's a really great place to look, Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries. Not only do they accredit big cat sanctuaries, they do horse sanctuaries, they're international. And then when it comes to big cats specifically, or wild cats, I should say, the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance is a group, a member organization of a group of sanctuaries and like-minded organizations and individuals, and you can become an individual member of those to support the same voice of saying that we don't think big cats should be exploited in the U.S. and that we do think we need stricter laws. We need to educate to keep the wild in your heart, not your home, because social media has made everybody want an exotic animal or a selfie with an exotic animal. And so really it's about coming together and creating one voice out to the media, out to social media to educate. And then, you know, we have so many volunteers at our sanctuaries. Accredited sanctuaries do need volunteers, and that can be helping with special events, writing thank you letters, coming on site and even doing dishes, because think of how many stainless steel bowls and tongs we go through feeding 150 big cats. So don't ever let your age deter you to help. There's so many ways to help animals. And, you know, definitely do your research that you're going to accredited organizations or organizations that are not buying, breeding, trading, or selling animals.
Okay, one quick follow-up. You mentioned something, I think I Googled it already, American Sanctuary Association. What is
American
organization?
American Sanctuary Association is not active right now. It was one of the startups. So they're still there, but that is kind of the startup of the Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries and Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance. But that is kind of an inactive association at this point. But we still have that, I mean, because it's really those are smaller organizations that are saying that we're trying to meet the same goals. But there isn't necessarily right now inspections as much through those organizations. It's really really trying to help kind of the startup sanctuaries.
Okay, thanks so much for your call and your interest. Yep. Appreciate it as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care. So one of the things I would say, just as a follow-up to the caller's question and your response, Tammy, is that if you go to various sanctuaries' websites, including wildcatssanctuary.org, usually there's information about what alliances, if any, they're part of. And also, crucially, although you have to double-check it against another source, you know, their status in terms of how they handle their charitable gifts and charitable giving.
Yes.
And that's how you can start to establish this is a legitimate sanctuary or one that's got sort of another agenda in mind. And you just keep checking it.
Charity Navigator and Charities Review Council are great for looking up nonprofits and where the money's going. Sure. Yeah, and here at the Wildcat Sanctuary, I mean, we do our work solely on donations. So when we talked about being, you know, assisting the Department of Justice or the local sheriff's department, rarely do we get compensated, and usually if we do, it's just out-of-pocket transport costs. We do that because we're a nonprofit. Of course, it would be wonderful in certain cases to get reimbursed for our expenses, but we go there not knowing that we're going to get any expenses reimbursed, and we go to our donors who want to see these animals live lives in better conditions and to end a cycle, and that's where our funding comes from. People that give $25 a month, you know, or that sponsor one of the residents here, there's just, you know, I can't tell you how much $5 makes a difference to an organization. You don't have to be giving $5,000 to make a difference.
Okay, so here's I want to get the question that kind of brings me to, in a sense, Tammy, but I just want to read a quick email that someone just wrote in saying, when Joe Exotic gets out of prison, is it still possible for him to own a tiger again?
Well, right now, no. Joe Exotic at this point is not allowed to own any exotics if he gets out, but that is a good thing. It is really case by case. So we did a case in Canada where it was a repeat offender because he was only sentenced after 300 animals were removed to 5 years not owning exotic animals. And even if he didn't own exotic animals, guess what? He sold his roadside zoo to the next person who sold. So we are really trying to educate not only judges, but the legal system that if we are going to reprimand these people, we need to make sure that they can't do this again. Sadly, it's a slippery slope because a lot of the animal welfare violations don't necessarily stick as much as the other criminal activity, like the racketeering or the human trafficking or the money laundering. And so that's really where they get the sentence, and the animal welfare violations a lot of times get dropped. Luckily, with the West Coast Game Park, out of 300 animals, he did plead guilty to 47 violations. So hopefully in his case, that will stick along with all the other criminal activities.
And I guess his sentencing isn't due till July, I want to say.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, it seemed like kind of a weird gap. I was hoping there'd be a little more swift on that, but.
Yes. There's usually always a gap. I mean, any legal case can take upwards to 2 to 2.5 years. And so it's a long time waiting. That's for sure. And we're seeing more tiger cubs now being trafficked. We get a lot of single tiger cubs that we're working with the Department of Justice through cartel trade, because second to drugs, wildlife animal trafficking is second largest in terms of illegal dollars. So it is big business, even when it's done, you know, on the black market.
Yeah. So I want to get maybe a little more into the West Coast Game Park situation and your guys' involvement in a sec. But one thing you were talking about in terms of fundraising and related things is, unlike some sanctuaries, you guys are clearly very adamant that you're not having any visitors, even like a special day a year or a special event thing. So I'd love to have you explain that, because just philosophically, there's different sanctuaries that have different thoughts on that, and some just, you know, need to pay the bills, but they're still very vigilant because there are certain standards for sanctuaries, that especially if they belong to that association. But often it's, you know, not being open to the public at all, and you seem super adamant about that at the Wildcat Sanctuary. So I'd love
to talk about that. Sanctuaries can be open to the public for public tours, but unlike other facilities, accredited sanctuaries, one, they have to be guided so that people receive an educational component. The animals are not forced to be on display. They should have den boxes, other yards to go into, things like that. So they do have strict standards. Our sanctuary have chosen to be closed to the public for a couple of reasons. One is we're in a really rural location, and in the beginning of the years, we were taking in really the toughest cases. We were taking in animals that didn't want to be on display. And that's back when the sanctuaries didn't have as much room and space as they do now. And so that was, we were fitting a niche and a need back then. But it really serviced us and our animals well, is that we can really concentrate on the animal care on a daily basis, that we are here for them. We do have donor days, but we only have 2 a year, and we limit it to no more than 50 people on site at a time, so that the animals still get peace and quiet. Yeah. But we do bring our animals because we think it's important to be transparent to our donors and supporters, that they get to see through social media how the animals live on a daily basis. So we'll do live posts on vet days. We'll go out and do live posts in a sanctuary stroll, because we do know it's important that they get to see where their money is going to help. But we are a sanctuary for animals, not a zoo for people. And it's really worked for us to be able to be closed to the public. And our footprint online is 3 million followers. So we can do more education in social media than we can would being open for tours. And yeah, so that's really served us well.
That's a significant difference, in that enables you to keep that stringent policy and still keep the bills paid, it sounds like.
Yes, Yes.
That's great. So let's talk a little bit more about the West Coast Game Park. First of all, how are cases determined that the Wildcat Sanctuary will get involved? Is it strictly by geography, or is it by the scope of the case, or what factors determine whether you'll get involved in if there's a raid on a particular roadside attraction or pseudo sanctuary or whatever the case may be?
Yeah, there's different avenues. So some, like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, will often call the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance, and I'm the rescue committee chair. So it'll come through that way. The West Coast Game Park came differently. It actually came to me as an individual based on our knowledge of doing large-scale rescues, international rescues. So, but I still used the same type of system that I do when it comes through the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance or the Wildcat Sanctuary personally. And that is, you know, we can't always accommodate all the animals here. And based on each animal and each animal's needs, it's not always best that they go to one sanctuary. It's best to find the best fit for that animal long term. And so then I did use the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance membership to say, hey, we know these are accredited facilities. Which space do we have? Space availability. If there's an animal that has the biggest veterinary need, I'd like them to go to the closest sanctuary where we're seizing them from with an on-site veterinarian. So those were kind of the decisions that were made. And sometimes it is just capacity. And so it'll go different. Sometimes other sanctuaries are contacted directly through law enforcement, or other times, you know, it goes through the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance. And so with the West Coast Game Park, when they reached out to us, we first had to create our own inventory of the animals, because they don't even know always the last time they were on site to know what exact animals are on site. So we go into investigative mode through social media, through TripAdvisor, through USDA inspection reports to try and complete with the complete list of what cats are on site, who lives with who, what might have medical needs have been addressed or showed, and then go from there of who can take those animals, who can transport. But when you go on site the day of, it's very limited, because if they're going on a federal raid, you need clearance. So they need to know everybody on site. You have to turn over your passports and your driver's license. You have to know which cats are going to what state, what legalities there are in those states for import permits, all that kind of thing, and transport. So our team went on site for the West Coast Game Park. There ended up being 15 wild cats. And then we had one day to sedate, remove, and do all the vet work, pre-exam vet work on all those cats. And then the sanctuaries that were helping came to a staging area and picked up the animals there once they were recovered from anesthesia. So it is a logistics, you know, is crazy. And rescue is usually one day, but I remind everybody that sanctuaries have up to 20 years per animal lifetime commitment. So everybody loves to cover the news of that big rescue and the seizure, but we don't want to forget the support sanctuaries need for the 20 plus years if they're taking in a young animal from that seizure, that they're going to need support. And so rescue is just day one.
Yeah, well, that brings me to kind of another question I had, because as I mentioned earlier in the show, I think we've touched on it since as well, the Wildcat Sanctuary took in four cats, I believe, that were part of the West Coast Game Park case. So in this situation and others, what's your own criteria for deciding when to bring cats into the sanctuary and how many you can bring?
Ours is what open enclosures we have or what we could build in a short term. Our goal is we don't want to put them in smaller spaces or longer term stress than that we're removing them from. So if we don't have an open habitat and can't get one built, we're going to go to the closest sanctuary that has an open habitat to get those animals out of quarantine and into a life of living free roaming as much as possible. But we also have an on-site veterinary care clinic, so we're known for taking in the toughest medical cases that might need a lot of micromanagement, a lot of medication, a lot of diagnostics. And so those are the cases we will definitely take if we're on site. And so it's really, we don't know the next cat we're going to rescue, and we don't know the next species, we don't know the age, and we don't know the health. And so that call will come in. We are working on a case right now that is different. It is a sanctuary that is closing its doors and is voluntary placing animals. So there's time and we're getting records, but usually we don't know. You know, we've gotten some cats in that have pregnant. We've gotten calls on cubs that were, you know, seized. So it's really an individual basis to make sure we can do the best for that animal at our facility. And if we don't have the space, we will network to make sure we can find some place to take that animal that meets the same standards.
Yeah, it sounds like in this new case you're talking about, people are fairly pleasant and agreeable, but sometimes there's such antagonism, right? People are super angry about being raided and about having to give up their thing. Yes. So they probably do everything to stand in your way.
Stand in the way, or if they have been tipped off on the raid, which happens a lot, the animals that are the highest price animals will end up being missing on the day of seizure. Yeah. You know, that they've already trafficked them, they sold them, they hid them. And so, again, because wheels of justice don't go in, and you're usually in small towns where word travels fast. It's definitely a strategic process to get as many animals out safely and do it as quickly as possible before they can remove animals.
And it's really great work that you're doing, obviously, because it's giving those cats a home or helping place them in other homes if you guys can't take them personally at the Wildcat Sanctuary. But it's also, you've kind of noted this, and it gave me a kind of a memory from many moons ago. But when you go to these sanctuaries, a lot of times, as you noted, the conditions are really poor and fencing is barely hanging on. And like 20 plus years ago, when I was still living in Southern California, there was a kind of a notable case in Colton, California. Mm-hmm. And so a few of us would go out periodically and try to feed the cats because they were in possession, but they hadn't been placed yet to paws and other places where they ended up going. And I still remember at feeding time, the fences were like basically collapsing. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like somebody's going to get super hurt here or worse. And, you know, they moved as quickly as they could. But I just thought, if you're going out on things periodically where you don't know what you're getting into in terms of facilities, are there special precautions you take in cases like, hey, this fence really isn't going to support that tiger who's starved and hasn't eaten in 2 or 3 days or whatever?
Absolutely. We first do a walkthrough and look at that, because we are always with insecure fencing, unlocked fencing, cats that could just climb out of the fencing. And so I think that, you know, TV makes it look like, oh, sedating an animal and darting an animal is the best way to do it. Honestly, if we have our choice, we will load the animal awake by putting up a transport crate, by gently coaxing the animal to step into the transport crate with food, because, you know, an awake animal is a safer animal. But there's many times it's just too unsafe, or you can't get your transfer crates up to the habitats or the cages that these roadside zoos have. And so we have to immobilize the animals. But, you know, and that's the time we'll take to do the veterinary exam, so we're not sedating them more than we have to. But usually the animal part we can handle. We'll bring extra fencing and chains and clips and locks. It's the people factor. We really need the authorities to remove the people from the property. And that happens on occasion, but a lot of times they'll do an on-site seizure and they'll just ask the person to stay in the house. And we've had guns pulled on us. We've had somebody try and open enclosures on us. We've had, you know, and so it's the human factor that is the wild card on cases like this.
Wow. Let me remind folks again, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Tammy Thies, founder and executive director of the Wildcat Sanctuary, a rescue refuge in Minnesota specializing in exploited, aging, and illegally wild cats. As we're hearing now, they often are very involved. If there's been a raid on a roadside zoo or other pseudo sanctuary, etc., they often are involved in placing the cats at their own sanctuary or helping place them elsewhere. So if you have any questions for Tammy, and we have a few more minutes left here, 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So I'd be curious to know, given how we kind of started the conversation, are you able to help kind of newer sanctuary people get launched or make progress in the same way that Tippi Hedren kind of helped you get started?
We sure are trying. You know, it's hard when you run your own facility that's already 80 hours a week. But I do a lot of mentoring with smaller sanctuaries. But the challenge is a lot of them are getting into it for the animals, which I get their heart. But I can't, you know, trying to convince them that they need to put funding and support into the business side, including salaries and things like that, to be sustainable is a challenge. You know, we all get into this, putting our own money into it, putting it on our own land, things like that. And we really I encourage people, yes, we need more facilities, but what we really need is those that are sustainable sanctuaries out there to get more support. Because if we've already have business models of accredited sanctuaries that can do this, they have succession planning in, they have multiple staff, and all we need is support to build more enclosures, that's an easier sustainability factor for the animals than a bunch of startups that might not make it. So we don't want to deter people from doing the right thing, but most people, just like I did in the beginning, thought like, oh, I'm going to save 10 or 20 animals in my backyard. And you know what? That you will fill up in a week if that's what your goal is. But you also need to make sure that you can delineate the assets of the person that founded it and the nonprofit. There's so much, like you said before, is you get into trouble by not fundraising enough, but also by not doing the business side. And you know, all startups are intertwined a little bit, but at some point there has to be a separation. So there is many sustainable sanctuaries that need support, volunteer support, funding support, you know, and they can build more and employ more, and they already have the model working.
You must be really glad that you kind of came into this world with a whole background and expertise and experience in the advertising and marketing and publicity and stuff, just because I'm sure that's been indispensable over the years in one way or another.
It's been really helpful, but I am not problem-free. I have made my share of mistakes over 25 years in this business, but I would really hope that my learning can prevent other people from making the same mistakes because there wasn't a rule book. And so, and marketing, you know, what I tell people is fundraising is my passion because, and marketing, because I know why I do this. I know why I've given up having a family and given up holidays and work around the clock. Our donors want to do what we do, but for some reason they can't, whether it's their age or their lifestyle or things. And so if we just bring them the behind the scenes of what our day is like, that has really been successful for us because people care about animals. They want to see the happy endings. You know, they want to prevent more animals from needing sanctuary just like we do. And so if we bring them along through the whole thing, it seems to really be, we've got lifelong supporters and we are so appreciative of them.
All right, Tammy, I'm sorry to say just about a minute left, but I'm very curious. These cases, as we've heard, routinely expose you to the worst elements of humanity to consistently exploit and neglect and abuse animals. How do you avoid burnout or periodic depression? Are there elements of self-care that you've learned over the years that you really need to do this so you just aren't vulnerable to just being beat up by this year in and year out?
Good question. Compassion fatigue is real in our industry. I see it all the time with our staff and ourselves. Self-care, we always put ourselves last. People feel like if we're not hurting, then we must not care enough for the animals. And our sanctuary really wants to pay our staff well, do benefits. We try to keep them to 40 hours a week. But personally, I really want to remember that it only takes one person to abuse an animal. It takes a network of lovely people to save an animal, from the person that complains to authority, to the sanctuary workers, to the donors. And so there still is a lot more good in the world wanting to help animals than the bad.
All right. Well, that's kind of a good upbeat note to end the conversation on. So again, we've been speaking with Tammy Thies from the Wildcat Sanctuary. Wildcatsanctuary.org is the website. And again, a huge presence on social media. You can easily search that. Tammy, thanks so much for joining us and talking animals. Thanks for all your great work helping all these cats over the years.
Thank you very much for having us.
For sure. Coming up on today's program, we'll hear my interview with Congressman Maxwell Alejandro Frost. He represents Florida's 10th District, which includes Orlando, site of this awful sloth world tragedy that made national headlines, if not international ones, maybe. Representative Frost is pivotal to calling attention to the sloth world debacle and helping resolve it. We'll hear that conversation with Congressman Frost in just a moment. Right now, we're going to step into the comedy corner with a longstanding fave, Brian Regan, and a piece called, part of a piece at least, called Flipper and General Ben on Talking Animals on WNF.
I watched a lot of Flipper growing up. Flipper, he was something. Always saving people. Every show he'd go save some more. I save some people! For that, they would throw him a dead fish. Hey, thanks. Thanks for saving people. He was always doing that backwards dance, three quarters out of the water. Man, that was cool. Imagine if you could do that. That'd impress some people at the public pool, you know? Just go, hey, how y'all doing? You know? Just skip across the top of the pool without getting your bathing suit wet and hop up on the other side. Hey, what's happening? And just grab a little towel, wipe off your feet. Man, it's a little colder than I thought.
That was Brian Regan, today's Comedy Corner, with part of a piece called Flipper and Gentle Ben, taken from his album simply entitled Live. Now it's time to hear the interview I recorded yesterday with Congressman Maxwell and Alejandro Frost about the horrible sloth world situation and what he did to help bring it into. This is on Talking Animals on WMNF. I know Congressman Frost is right here somewhere. All right, let's hear him now on Talking Animals on WMNF. What was the first detail that you heard along the way that concerned you, that made you think this could be a significant problem and I need to intervene?
Well, it was hearing about the situation in the first place. I mean, we had tons of people write into the office, call the office, send me messages. Then one of our state representatives, Anna Escamani, sent me a text about it. And looking into it and finding out that over 30 sloths died at that point, now we know it's even more than that, shocked me, especially in a place like Central Florida, where, you know, we pride ourselves in doing things right and on behalf of not, you know, just tourists and people in our community, but also animal welfare. And the first thing I thought of is, if this person can do this and still open their company without any repercussions, it means it can happen anywhere and it can happen again and again and again. And so we looked into it immediately because of that.
And what were your kind of first steps having that reaction in deciding to order a federal investigation, which I guess you did fairly early on as well?
First thing I did is I got with my team and said, let's learn everything we can learn about this. What happened, but also let's look into all the animal welfare laws and see, where did this person slip through the cracks? Why wasn't there better coordination between the state agency and the federal agency? What permits might be outstanding for this person, and how can we intervene to ensure that the federal government denies that person the permit they need because they've already proven that they don't know what the hell they're doing? And so my team, we spent a whole day looking into the law, figuring that out, and that's why the next day we took action, reaching out to the to USDA and also working with local partners to figure out what else we could do. Of course, calling for a federal investigation, but the most important thing we did is we pushed USDA and said, you cannot accept the permit that this guy needs. You can't give him the permit he needs to open up shop. And not just that, but there's also a press component. We hit the press, we hit social media to make sure that people, and I used my platform to ensure that people understood what was going on. So those were the immediate steps, but there's also a longer term thing here. The law failed these animals and failed our community. And there's a lot more that we need to do in terms of ensuring oversight is legit and works so this doesn't happen again.
So just backing up for one moment, when you decided to look into the, spend that day looking into things and order the investigation, were there any voices before the scope of this fiasco was really known, kind of suggesting that the federal investigation was maybe too big of a response, disproportionate to the initial reports about the sloth deaths, or was everybody supportive all along the way?
Everyone was supportive. And, you know, for me, there's no issue too big or too small for me to handle and for me to, you know, to warrant my attention as a member of Congress that represents my community. And when I have hundreds of people reaching out to me about an issue, regardless of what it is, I'm going to look into it. And I'm going to figure out ways that I can use where I work, which is in the federal government, to not just remedy it, to not just hold people accountable, but to ensure it never happens again.
This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Congressman Maxwell Alejandro Frost, who represents Florida's 10th District, which includes Orlando, and we're discussing the horrific sloth world situation and its resolution. Unit's interview was recorded yesterday. So it feels like the sloth situation has now reached a resolution of sorts. Obviously, I guess there'll be no sloth world, and the 13 surviving sloths are now at the Central Florida Zoo. Did you have a hand in negotiating that solution?
We didn't negotiate the solution. We do think us moving forward with putting this, pushing this federal investigation and pushing him to not receive the permits he was going to receive definitely led to him deciding to abandon the project. That plus all of the organizer, activists, and people who made a lot of noise about this in the public eye. I mean, they made the calculation that, number one, now that we have a member of Congress and politicians pushing for us to not receive the permit we need to open, we probably won't receive it. And number two, even if somehow we did receive the permit, we would probably have protests outside of our place. And I even said on an interview, you would catch me at those protests, and you'd catch me hosting press conferences outside of the establishment as well. We don't want that kind of stuff in Central Florida, and we don't want it representing our community. And so I'm glad the right decision was made. Of course, the 13 sloths that are at the zoo right now are, you know, hanging on, right? We're hoping that they'll be fine. And, you know, it's just a horrible situation. And this is what happens when our government doesn't do what it needs to do. Because everyone has to remember that in August of last year, the state did an audit of the facility and they found a ton of different issues. But obviously, those issues weren't enough to stop this guy from bringing in these animals into a facility and then dying in mass. There's obviously issues with the state government communicating with the federal government. And there's an even bigger issue that we're going to continue to work on, which is called the opening loophole. And essentially what this means is you need the permit to essentially open your facility so people can view the animals that you have. But you actually don't need a permit when they hit your facility, right? And so because technically you're closed, you don't need that USDA permit. We think that's wrong. He should have needed a permit the second those animals became under his care in his facility. And had that been the law, and had that been the rule, these sloths might be alive right now. And so we're going to continue to, you know, work with USDA to figure out how we can close that loophole that obviously has been exploited by this guy. But everyone has to remember, this is obviously not the only situation. I mean, if it happened here to this degree, imagine what else has happened across the country and what could happen if we don't take action.
So again, it's sort of illustrative of loopholes, literally and figuratively, in laws and how they're brought to your attention, unfortunately, in the midst of a tragic loss and a number of sloths. But that being corrected and remedied because of this situation be getting so much spotlight and focus and so many voices raising a ruckus about it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is why oversight's important. It's not to stifle things. It's not to throw more red tape at people. We know government already has too much red tape. But it's to ensure, especially when we're talking about endangered species, when we're talking about the care of living things, whether they're when we're talking about people, when we're talking about animals, you know, it is important that we have real oversight here. And there wasn't the oversight necessary. And even with a government entity checking things and saying, you're not ready to receive these animals, he was still able to receive the animals and kill them. And that's why we're in the situation we're in. So we just want to make sure that we have the checks and balances necessary. So that way, you know, private corporations, which is essentially, you know, what this guy is, can't just run amok with some of the most endangered animals in our world. And so there's just a lot more we need to do around this. And, you know, we're happy to, you know, continue to be one voice of many in this fight.
Yeah, and it sounds like there, from what people first heard about, got up in arms, there's actually a different timeline. And this guy had been having these thoughts as early as 2024, I believe, when all of a sudden it seemed like it was this a story that was just breaking in the last few weeks. And like many things, it turns out it's a darker story once you start probing into it.
A much darker story, yep.
So I'm curious now that those 13, let's hope they continue to survive at the Central Florida Zoo. Who's absorbing the cost of caring for those surviving sloths?
I believe it's the zoo itself. I think they're fundraising right now and asking people to donate to get help in taking care of the remaining animals.
Now, what kind of charges, I think, are being filed against Peter Bondre, I guess it's pronounced, the so-called entrepreneur behind Sloth World?
I'm not sure what the specific charges are right now, but we are continuing to push USDA to open up a federal investigation. There has to be accountability for what happened.
For sure. All right.
All right. Thanks again to Congressman Maxwell Frost. And stay tuned for the conversation with Martin.